Welcome to A Cult of Personality, Esoteric Podcast Extraordinaire. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky, and you can find our website at occultofpersonality.net, featuring an extensive archive of recorded interviews. I'm thrilled to be able to bring you episode 155, featuring an interview with author Craig Williams about his excellent book, Cave of the Numinous, Tantric Physics, Volume 1, from Theon Publishing. A Cult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and by the subscribers to the A Cult of Personality membership section. This episode is also made possible by an additional donation from Steve in the UK and from Todd. Thanks again. A Cult of Personality podcast is also sponsored by Miskatonic Books, an online store that focuses on the esoteric, occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, witchcraft, the Golden Dawn, as well as dark fantasy, classic horror, and supernatural fiction. They carry books by all your favorite esoteric publishers as well. Just visit miskatonicbooks.com. A Cult of Personality podcast is also brought to you by Thelesis Aura, an occult media production, education, and resource company. Publishers of Lon Milo Duquette's Tarot of Ceremonial Magic. Distributors of Kat Luneau's Sacred Imagery. And host to online training and instruction by some of the world's leading teachers of the esoteric arts. For more, visit ThelesisAura.com. The Hermetic Arts Learning Center, located in historic Salem, Massachusetts, offers unique instruction in the arcane arts from some of the most experienced and talented teachers around. The Hermetic Arts Learning Center is committed to the authentic Western esoteric tradition by providing students with quality, in-depth classes along with all the books and ritual tools one could ever want, many of them handcrafted. The ancient mysteries have a new home in the Witch City. Stop by the shop or visit online at hermeticarts.com. A Cult of Personality podcast is also brought to you by Metabolic Alchemy, alchemical elixirs for health and personal development. Metabolic Alchemy offers alchemical elixirs based on the five elements of Western alchemy. Focus on one element, or take the complete journey through the elements program to refine all the elements of your nature. Metabolic Alchemy also produces wellness elixirs for sinus, sleep, energy, and relaxation. Visit metabolic-alchemy.com. Now, in episode number 155, an interview with Craig Williams. The main subject is his book, Cave of the Numinous, Tantric Physics, Volume 1. Highly anticipated and the result of over 25 years of initiatic study within authentic guru lineages, Cave of the Numinous by Craig Williams is one of the very few genuine expositions of the left-hand path in general and left-handed tantra in particular. Radical in its approach, the tantric way of the dark goddess is a most intense and dangerous pathway towards spiritual liberation and power. Sexual alchemy, guru yoga, antinomian ritual, and complex interactions of various Vedic sciences form a fascinating universe of spiritual transformation within which the wayfarer may attain to the supreme freedom of Kaivalya or suffer utter destruction. In Cave of the Numinous, Craig Williams expounds on most important roots of left-hand practice and guides us into the nocturnal inner and outer environments which the practitioner must establish in order to successfully progress along the Vama Marga. Complete with rituals and glossary, this book is an invaluable resource and manual for every serious occultist and esoteric explorer, particularly for those of the left-hand gnosis. Cave of the Numinous features the exclusive essay Supreme Katabasis, Kaivalya, and the Cosmic Gnosis by David Beth as an introduction and is available at theonpublishing.com. That's T-H-E-I-O-N publishing.com. Craig Williams is one of the most innovative and important contemporary occult Gnostics and is a close personal student of David Beth. He is a bishop of the Ecclesia Gnostica Aeterna and a highly empowered adept of esoteric Vudan. Moving beyond a conservative, myopic view of Vedic studies, Williams has evolved a unique system of esoteric Hinduism and left-hand Tantra over 25 years of initiatic study in Yoga, Ayurveda, Tantra, Jyotish, and Vedanta. With undergraduate degrees in religious studies, philosophy, and English literature, and a master's degree in Oriental medicine, Craig lives in Austin, Texas, where he operates a busy private medical practice specializing in traditional Chinese medicine, acupuncture, and Ayurveda. He is a licensed acupuncturist and a professional member of the American Herbalist Guild and National Ayurvedic Medical Association. Williams' medical and esoteric writings have appeared in various journals and anthologies. More information can be found at his website, AyurvedaAustin.com. Craig Williams has appeared 3 times previously on the podcast. First, in Eastern Thought in the Western Occult World, the recording of the panel discussion from the 2012 Esoteric Book Conference. Then, in episode 129, discussing Beyond the Paths of Frustration, Da'at Gnosis, his article for Clavis Journal. And most recently, in the recording of the historic Voices of Modern Gnosticism panel discussion. You can find links in the show notes to all 3 of these episodes, as well as Theon Publishing to purchase Craig's book, Cave of the Numinous. I greatly appreciate Craig's work, and it's a privilege to be able to bring you this interview. I'm continually impressed by Craig's dedication, brilliance, independent spirit, and unwillingness to compromise his ideals. His insights into esoteric Hinduism are applicable to any tradition, and we're fortunate to have such a luminary in times when initiation has never been more of a commodity. Craig Williams, I want to welcome you back to the podcast. It's really great to speak with you once again.
Oh, it's excellent to be here, Greg. Thanks.
Yeah, it's a real privilege to be able to talk with you. In person, no less.
Even better.
Right. Your book, Cave of the Numinous, was recently published by Theon Publishing.
Yes.
It has been very highly acclaimed book. Subtitle, I should mention, is Tantric Physics 1.
Right.
And I understand that this is part of a projected series of books.
Definitely, yeah. This will be just the beginning of at least 3 volumes, maybe even 4. And so it's kind of setting the stage just for further things to be explored. Definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just the beginning.
It's a really great book. I find it to be pretty unique
This
realm. We were talking the other night, and I'll open up with this one. I felt when I was reading it that it was very reminiscent of the feeling I had years ago reading Arthur Avalon's The Serpent Power,
I think it is.
The way he was able to look to a foreign tradition, at least for me, and bring back like these pearls of wisdom, and I walked away having a much
greater understanding of something than I ever thought I possibly could. And I had the same type of experience reading your book.
Oh, that's an honor. Yeah. I mean, that was my vision with the book, is I wanted it to be almost like a travel journal, mm-hmm. like that someone's had gone somewhere and had written some ideas and brought them back. They're a little bit pre-digested.
Yeah.
And so that was, so for you to say that is the best I could ever hope for. Yeah.
I want to mention also, there's a really special foreword or introduction to the book by David Beth.
Yes, yes.
And he says some things that, I don't know, maybe controversial.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about his message and how it differs from much of what is taught in the esoteric realm.
Yeah, that's really important. I mean, David and I had a vision for this book, and we really wanted it to be many things, but we definitely wanted it to be some kind of start or a seed for any tradition to have, to be able to take and take those tools. And then we also wanted it to be a kind of a voice of our type of gnosis, which we would term cosmic gnosis, which is David's unique contribution to both a system of Vudan, a system of Gnosticism proper, and then the idea of tantric physics being a type of subset of that.
Right.
And so I think it's wonderful. David's essay is so great because, it, in my opinion, it takes this idea of tantric physics way out of just a yogic or a Vedic subset, and kind of broadens the scope to say, hey, this is much bigger than you might think it is on the first idea.
Yeah.
And then within that, David has some very important ideas that we believe in about how we view our Gnosticism, how it's a distinctly different from many other systems in Gnosticism, and how it's a very much a radical approach, very much in many ways a tantric approach.
That's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. We see the body as a sacred vehicle for the soul, and that the world is some place where we want to explore and connect with on a soul level, which is actually very tantric, at least left-hand tantric.
One of the points you made early in the text is right up front, talking about how in the West, and maybe even in the East, like, we don't even have a clear word to describe the tradition we're trying to look at. It's often referred to as Hinduism, and then you clearly correct that in the book.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, that's even in the world of Hindu studies or Vedic studies, you'll get people arguing back and forth of what that means. You have like fanatical right-wing Hindus and leftist Marxist Hindus. So it was very important for me to, which might be a little over zealous, was to literally try to redefine what I was referring as Hinduism. Mm-hmm. And when I say esoteric Hinduism, it's a unique system, which is tied back to David's idea of cosmic gnosis, which we use as our group. So it will differ from a lot of other systems they might call Hinduism, in the sense that it's an extensive kind of almost like a integrative view of using every limb of Vedic gnosis. But you know, it brings up a good question, because, or a good point rather, because we even kind of redefine Vedic in the book. I make a big point to say, when we say Vedic, we mean this ancient primordial system,
right?
And not just a stuffy academic Brahmanic system like that. So I think when we talk about esoteric Hinduism, that's why I wanted to take the time to show that.
Yeah,
it's a very occult system, a type of, and it is a type of physics,
right?
You know,
I get a strong sense that you put a lot of value in things that are more ancient, and I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the importance of tradition and why things that some of the oldest traditions on earth are maybe some of the most important, and certainly to you.
Yeah, absolutely, to me. Yeah, I mean, to me, in my opinion, for the things that I'm most passionate about as a Gnostic would be ancient African traditions, ancient traditions from India or Southeast Asia, and then ancient Sufi systems. And so to me, those are the most interesting and fertile grounds for me. And then I think tradition is important because tradition connects us back to this ancient type of either we say a parampara or ancient egregore or some kind of a primordial system that which we can use to fuel all our modern explorations. Of course, that word traditionalism is littered with a lot of problems. So I think that's always going to be a problematic thing. I'm not going to try to reclaim the word traditionalism. However, I do think it's very good to have a tradition. But traditions also need to evolve too.
Right.
You know, and even within the system of Ayurveda, Ayurvedic medicine, even Chinese medicine, which are some of my specialties, each, you know, practitioner would master the tradition and then maybe revise it in some way. But he or she would only be able to revise the tradition after honoring the regular traditional systems, and they would say, here's what I've mastered, and now here's what I'm going to say I think is different about it. And people would listen to them if they honored the tradition and then showed what they were going to be different.
Right.
And so I think even if you want to morph the tradition and evolve it, you still have to honor it. You know, instead of just being a blind renegade.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. I think that's true. This is just kind of an aside, but a lot of the academic analysis I've read, when they look at what they call traditionalist school, primarily coming from like Guanan,
yeah,
as like the fountainhead of that kind of way of thinking.
Sure.
They talk a lot about this idea of like almost like traveling back through the mists of time to this primordial unknown.
Yes.
That all we have today kind of came out of at some way or another, but
sure.
We can only kind of glance like the adumbrations of this
yeah.
thing through what we have today.
Sure, sure.
And is that how you feel?
I think so, but I think some of that gets a little bit, you know, almost too mystified in some ways. And so, but I think if we want to, for example, in our system of Gnosticism, which David coined the term, a type of cosmic gnosis, we often use the term primordial. And so, of course, it's there. We look at something ancient. Mm-hmm. And so, but I think to do that, if you want to track back or trace back, then you need to look at some of the more ancient systems.
Yeah.
And so I think that's one of the reasons why I've been so passionate about African systems or Southeast Asia,
yeah.
Sufi systems, because then you can kind of start to see what was going on. I don't believe in this kind of fantastical past mm-hmm. where everything was perfect and mm-hmm. and everything was magical. We've just lost it. I think there was a magical time. The sense of consciousness was different,
yeah.
without a doubt.
Yeah.
So I think they definitely might have seen, you know, often talk about seeing with the eyes of the heart,
mm-hmm.
the Sufi term, or seeing with the eyes of the soul, or something which I talk a lot about, a sacramental vision. I think maybe in those more ancient times, they may were able to do that. But I also think that, you know, there's going to be a constant transformation. There's going to be a constant evolution. And so we can't just return to that mystical past.
Right.
And I think we see a lot of problems today with people kind of turning traditionalisms into a fundamentalism. And that to me is dangerous too.
It can be.
It can be, you're right.
Yeah.
So I think it's a tricky thing. But I think, you know, I often think of it a lot like music. That if someone's going to evolve a musical system, they might have mastered the basics.
Right.
Or even if you meet a musician, and the most of the time, who is a really master of his or her art, they're a great, they just know a huge amount of musical history.
Yes.
Or they're a huge aficionado of ancient blues,
right.
you know. And so I think to me, that's how I see these systems. We respect the teachings, we honor them, but then we have a huge responsibility to evolve it in a way that respects it.
Yeah, that's a great analogy.
Which
though.
Keeps it real, you know. So I think that's something that we try to do. It's going to change and evolve, but we still need to keep something of its essence. And that's what we hope for. So, and that's kind of what I'm hoping for when I talk about esoteric Hinduism,
mm-hmm.
or I talk about a tantric physics.
Right.
Or even in our esoteric Budan, we seek to kind of change it and move on, but help it evolve in a respectable manner.
Yeah, that's really a good word. It does show a lot of respect and placing the importance of what has come before almost honoring it more so by evolving it in your own way and not trying to continually imitate what has already been done.
You absolutely nailed it. And I think that's something I would hope people would see. That, yeah, you're it's a huge responsibility. You're not just supposed to be a parrot.
Right.
And kind of continue that on, that there is going to be something that you need to evolve with that. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's huge. It's a wonderful point. I'm really glad you brought that up.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely comes through, I feel.
Wonderful.
Not just the book, but like a lot of other things that you do as well.
Excellent. That's wonderful. That's the best we could hope for.
Right.
You know, so.
One of the major takeaways from your book is the importance of having a teacher, mm-hmm. guru, master, whatever you want to call that person,
right.
who can transmit that wisdom really from the beyond,
yes.
you know, to you as the student. And I know there's a lot of resistance to that idea
in Definitely.
Certain circles. I've been guilty of it myself in the past.
Sure, sure.
But I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the importance of a teacher and why it's so crucial.
Yeah, I'd love to. I mean, that's a big part of my whole idea about this first volume was to talk about that. And I think the word guru has a lot of connotations which are threatening to a lot of people. I mean, in its essence, the word guru means, you know, someone which dispels darkness. So, I mean, that's fine.
Right.
But then in the modern time, we people tend to think that means someone who's like a god to you or controls your every thought, which can be problematic. And so I think that the essence of that idea is that, at least in the systems that I practice and the systems that David Beth practices and these ancient systems, that there had to be a literal, a physical transmission of the gnosis. It wasn't something which happened on the astral plane or
right.
a self-initiation of sorts. And so I think that that idea of this one-to-one transmission, which we would say in Sanskrit, gurukula, which meant a one-to-one transmission from the teacher to the student, I think is very vital. And I think magical things happen when you allow that space to start to grow. And between the teacher and the student, it creates a specific esoteric realm. Mm. A specific esoteric environment where things can be conducive to grow, to ferment, almost like an incubation. And so I think that's what I hope to see, even to hope to reawaken for every system, and whether it's a straight occult system, a Gnostic system, whatever you want to call it, I think that one-to-one mentorship, teacher-student relationship is A, being lost today, and then B is really vital
yeah.
for something to, for not only for it to stay alive, but for us to be able to evolve it mm-hmm. in a respectable way.
Right.
So.
A couple things come to mind as I'm listening to you talk about this. One of which is in like ceremonial magic or initiatory situations, let's say, there's always a moment when the hierophant or whoever's in running the show touches the candidate or the initiate.
Yes.
And there's a transmission, like an energetic physical
transmission
happening. And I feel like this is a little bit of what you're talking about.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's exactly what I'm talking about. Because you have a metaphorical transmission
mm-hmm.
that definitely happens with teacher student, guru student, and I think it's important to remember too that those transmissions can be transverbal. Mm-hmm. They can be happen in situations that are very mundane. They can happen in a way that you initially don't even perceive it. Almost like the Sufi stories about the voyager who's looking for the magical land and then doesn't even realize he or she's been there till they left.
Yes.
You know, I think that's how it is. Oftentimes you leave with your teacher, you spend a week with your teacher, then you go back home and you realize, oh my gosh, this happened and that happened, but at the time I didn't realize it.
Yeah.
And so that's one level. But the other thing is what you're saying, it could also will be in a very ritualistic manner. And there'll be a laying on the hands.
Yeah.
And so when that happens, there is like a transmission.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a literally a physical one too.
Yeah.
And so I think both those, it's very important.
I agree. I to me personally, those types of experiences have been like the key.
Absolutely. I would agree with that too. And I would even, I mean, some of my experiences with my teachers, which happened that way, were much more powerful than any magical or mystical place I visited in India.
Wow.
You know, that was that actual transmission of a hand to touch, was just as powerful as being at Mount Kailas or something like that.
Wow.
So I think that's something that maybe the Mount Kailas environment made that happen. It's hard to say. Okay. You never know. So, I mean, I think they're all kind of playing into visiting sacred sites can be transformative.
Yeah, yeah.
Without a doubt. And if you could visit a sacred site with your teacher, even better.
Good point.
So, laying on the hands could happen anywhere.
Yeah.
And then you literally move into that ritual space, which is outside of mundane time and space, and sacred things can happen. Yeah. So, and that's important. We need to still have that, honor that. Understand that it's a very effective means of transformation and transmission both.
Yeah. There's another question that all this leads me to ask, and I don't know exactly how to phrase it. Oftentimes I've experienced what I would call a physiological reaction, some kind of like purification type of thing, being in the presence of certain people who have devoted their lives to teaching and wisdom and
absolutely
traditions.
Definitely. No, that's huge. I think that's it's a resonance.
Mm-hmm.
I even like to refer to it as some type of esoteric resonance.
Mm-hmm.
That our body literally will have a physiological expression from that. I mean, literal secretions in the nervous system can happen. And that's the same thing that we seek to happen during a good, powerful ritual or meditative states.
Right.
And I think those things are happening through conversations, but even just them, that maybe the practitioner has developed a certain type of magical ojas through their practices, and so that has a type of radioactivity.
Yeah.
And that kind of goes out, and that should... Even within that, you're in that realm, something starts to shift.
Yeah.
And it's like you're kind of strange things can happen in that realm, which can be moving into really a type of quantum weirdness.
I agree. I picked up on this years ago, and I've noticed it very consistently happen to the point where I'm like, this seems like it's very reproducible. And I imagine someone who is kind of attuned to that, if they're in the presence of like a real spiritual master, it's got to be like, you know, like putting your hand in the electric socket.
It's palpable.
Yeah.
You can really feel it, you know. And so I think that's something that we need to cherish and honor and respect and start to kind of allow people to get into that space more than maybe people see it now. And I think some people, they just become, there's so much like pranic residue from life that kind of clouds their perceptions through our modern mundane world, the kind of problems with that. So hopefully their spiritual practice starts to clear that.
Right.
And then they can start to sense that more.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's a sensitivity, but it's not a sensitivity which makes you feel necessarily bad or not adjusted. It's just more, you should be more perceptual.
Yeah.
Like we could literally say like seeing or hearing with the eyes of the heart.
That's really the best way you could put it, because, yeah, it's. I don't know that I'd be able to teach somebody else like what to look for, or
exactly
like how to like experience this type of thing.
No, and if you have that esoteric resonance, and then within that, you know, special field that's happening, then that's when the transformations just take on an exponential leap. A discussion, a reading, a mass, something like anything starts to just really amplify in its potential at that point.
Yeah.
Which is really, really important. So
it's huge.
And sometimes it's hard to predict that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not quantifiable always. Like if we do this, and that's going to happen. And so, but you still want to try to create some environment where it's conducive.
Yeah. To be honest with you, the times that I've noticed it the most have been like one-on-one conversations.
I agree.
People.
Yeah. And so that's kind of what we, that's why, you know, it really is important to take the time to allow that to happen. Mm-hmm. And that's when that teacher-student relationship to, and it's hard. I know people have busy schedules. It's tough for them to travel, to be, they feel like they're not, if they don't have a teacher around them, it can't happen. So we might have to make sacrifices.
That's the thing. I mean, anything in life that's really worthwhile, you're going to have to sacrifice for it.
Simple as that. Yeah. You can't say, well, you know, I don't live there, so I'm going to have to travel, so therefore I don't want to do it. That, you've already lost at that point. So, yeah. So I think these are really important things to think about. And these are things that aren't Hindu.
Right. You're right. most of the things we've talked about.
I mean, this book might have some ideas about esoteric Hinduism and Tantra, but physics it applies in every culture.
Okay.
That's even why I wanted to use that term tantric physics. It's right. Physics in India versus physics in America versus physics in the UK. It's all physics.
Yeah.
And we should have that kind of vocabulary, mm-hmm. which we can talk about. And sure, there might be some little technicalities here and there. I mean, that's why we even have a vocabulary in my book, index in the book, right. Where people can look up certain words and they'll know what we mean. But the material in my book, anyone, regardless of their system, they could take and implement mm-hmm. and anything, even if they didn't have an interest in Hinduism or Tantra per se. That kind of transmission, the idea of study, it goes across the boards. Yeah.
So, just to elaborate a little bit on that, the richness of these more ancient traditions kind of leads us to see that the traditions we have in the West, though they're relatively young in comparison, mm-hmm. are in need of a lot of material, a lot of work. There's a lot to be done.
Yes.
These systems we have, if we compare them to what's in the East, sometimes it looks like just a framework.
Exactly.
And I'm just wondering if you can talk about, you know, trying to inspire people to...
That's the thing. Yeah, and that's a really great analogy. I think that in many of our practices in what we say the Western world mm-hmm. or / modern world even, we're kind of building frameworks. We're kind of trying to build these frameworks, but oftentimes it's like a framework without a foundation. And so there might be kind of interesting frameworks, but there's no roof. Or there's windows, but there's not a wall. And so I think that's one of the benefits is if we look at these ancient foundational systems and then we take the modern ideas of framework, then we can really start to create something very unique. And I think that's the hope for, because I think we, like I said before, I have no glamorization of the past. I mean, there's no need to go back to the past to solve the modern day problems. I definitely do not fall into that category of people who believe that, oh, after this mythical Kali Yuga, there's going to be this golden age in the future, and in this magical future, everything's going to be perfect. I don't believe that at all. I think that's a transcendent fantasy.
Utopian.
It's a utopian, monistic, egoistic fantasy. It's like this ego, mm-hmm. this major bloated ego that's trying to do that. So it takes us away from the present and it creates this kind of mythical future. So I think I think we should avoid that. Even my use of the term Kali Yuga to me is very symbolic. That's something I will probably talk more in the second volume, but it has a power because we know what it's referring to.
Yeah.
But I don't think that I'm saying, oh, and this at 432,000 years of Kali Yuga is going to be instantly over. Then we move into the Dwapara Yuga. Then we move into the magical. That's just not my belief. And so those are interesting ideas to discuss. But I think that we definitely need to evolve something. But if we're going to evolve, that we need both a foundation and then we need innovation.
Yeah.
So I think if you have a foundation with innovation, then you can really see some change happen, and at least some kind of inspiring things.
That kind of leads me to another question, kind of related, which is these ancient traditions, a lot of mostly from the East or Africa or Indonesia or Southeast Asia or whatever, you had people who were totally devoted to doing this 24/7.
Absolutely.
Like, all the time.
Absolutely.
And in the West, there's very few people like that.
Yes.
Which leads me to wonder if it's even possible to approach the richness of some of these more ancient traditions when, you know, we're only spending like 2 hours a day, if that, on it.
That's a very sobering question, and I think it's a question that should be asked over and over again. Because that's what we look at these ancient teachers, these ancient systems, the reason why they lived in another world, the reason why they had another ensouled vision of a cosmos which was alive, which today we see as this empty wasteland, It's because they lived it there in life. Everything about their culture was enshrined with it. And so I think if we want to return to that, if we want to like reawaken that in us, then we have to really be honest with ourselves about what we're willing to do and what we're willing to either give up or accomplish or try, and then be realistic about that. And so I think that is a sobering question, but it also shows you the seriousness of the path.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why we refer to it as the merciless path, or I always say, you know, there's no tourist on this journey.
Yeah.
You can be a tourist and get some little glimpses here and there, but then the tourist has to go home, mm-hmm. as opposed to the pilgrim on the path, that's their path. Yeah. That's the life. And so I think, and you can still get some really interesting inspirations from being a tourist. You know?
Oh, yeah.
You can have a great trip and go home and still get some inspiration. So I think you have to have a calling to be that, to feel that. And so if you really have a true calling to that, then I think it can be relatively easy. It's almost like there's no way you can't do it. You know, for me, I can't imagine not dedicating my life to these systems. But that has in no way made my life easy. That does not mean anything like that. If anything, It's made my life much more challenging. Mm-hmm. But it's also made it incredibly rewarding.
Yeah.
So, I didn't expect it to not be.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think that's the thing. So I think we just have to be honest with ourselves. Mm-hmm. But then the last thing, I think that is one of the reasons why I think it makes me have such a reverence for teachers.
Yeah.
Because teachers have dedicated so much of their life. And, you know, some of these casual conversations with your teacher, it seems so casual, but they've had to do this over, you know, 40 years, 30 years, 50 years. And then they kind of pre-digest it and hand it to us. And especially in our modern age where it's just like instant information, constantly instant information. And in the old days, people would have to memorize an entire book.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, we take for granted that stuff today. So I think that's why honoring our teachers. And I think that even is a kind of a nod to ancestor worship.
Yeah, that's
is honoring these ancient people that dedicated their lives, and in our systems, and the systems that David Beth and I, and the EGA and our esoteric Buddha on, we see the dead as very alive. Mm-hmm. There's a symbiotic relationship between that dead and alive, and so they still transmit information.
Oh, yeah.
And so then, and when we die, it's just a rebirth into another state of consciousness. And so I think that's an idea to think about too. But that also is a real sobering view.
It is a sobering view, but I can. Totally. My experiences have completely are in agreement with exactly what you say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's very true.
It's a light, and that's why I even refer to it as like a night consciousness, mm-hmm. a night vision. We have a, you know, like a day vision and a night vision, so we have to sometimes literally reacquaint our eyes. It's like a night vision. You have to get used to the dark or let your eyes get adjusted to that type of light. And so it's hard just to jump back and forth, you know, and so sometimes you have to say, okay, and that might mean taking periods of retreat and mm-hmm. and organizing your life in a way. I mean, that's even another idea for my book, is I wanted to bring up some questions for people just to start like asking themselves, why do they want to do this? Why do they want to learn this? Why do they want to communicate with this deity or try this tradition? You might just have to start looking at your life and say, is my life even in order to start that?
Yeah.
You know, and so I think that's a really good thing for us to do, is like just to start preparing the ground. And if you start preparing the ground, and then when you meet the teacher, something can happen.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you prepare the ground, you're just kind of building a foundation that you could dive deeper in.
Yeah.
So I think that's an idea. It's kind of not discussed a lot today, too.
Interesting. I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about Tantra
Yeah.
What it is, what it isn't.
Sure.
You did this a little bit during the panel discussion for the EBC.
Absolutely.
But my perception is that there's still a lot of confusion on this subject.
And the subject's huge. You know, that's why even I stated in my, I think, believe in the introduction, like, this is not meant to be another academic treatise on Tantra. There's plenty of that out there. But I think for me, and when I refer to Tantra physics, it's literally a magical way of viewing the world, particularly left-hand Tantra, because left-hand Tantra views the physical body as an alchemical tool. And so Tantric, a vision of that would be living your life and seeing the world as a magical, artistic expression of a type of alive cosmos. A cosmos which is pandemonic, filled with vitalism in every realm. For example, in the Tantric vision, for me, trees are alive, the moon is alive, the seasons are alive, animals are alive. Everything has a soul that is alive that I could communicate with if I allow myself that type of symbiosis. Mm-hmm. And when you do that within these systems, then there can be an internal alchemical transformation. Mm. And that might entail physical practices, mental practices. It can run the gamut of what that means. And I think left or right hand Tantra has infinite implications with that. Some are frightening to some people, some not. But for left-hand Tantra, essentially means it's just body affirming. And it's not going to see the body as something which is flawed. And it's not going to have some kind of transcendent fantasy into the future. Mm-hmm. That you have to leave this world to find something magical. And I think we can even see that happening now as some kind of like a science fiction fantasy. If we just leave this planet Earth and go to another planet, will be better.
Sure.
Tantra would, that's not what we would think with that. So it means we have to live in this world, immerse ourselves into this world. However, the body is finite.
It's so strange to me, but I think it's because we're not like physically rooted in the earth like a tree, that we somehow think of ourselves as independent from the earth.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah,
and I totally feel like that's a completely wrong-headed idea.
It's a problem. It's a really big problem with that. It's an escapist tendency where we're not connected to our bodies, we're not connected to the earth.
Well, I see this too in ideas that get spread around, like humans were like seeded by aliens somehow, like genetic manipulation going on.
That is, to me, I'm so glad you brought that up, because that is, to me, one of the biggest like fantasy lands that we're exploring into. That's another way of just taking away more power to some transcendent thing. And mm-hmm. I'm a huge critic of this Vedic aliens idea.
Right.
It's like we have to have an alien to make the Vedas. It's
right.
Just absurd. Mm-hmm. It's like saying there has to be aliens in Africa to have esoteric voodoo. It's just absurd. Mm-hmm. And that. So I think that those are really powerful things to think about. That we have to look at this body as something sacred. And then, that's why I think emphatically, I really am passionate about believing that, particularly with Tantra, one has to use Ayurveda. You have to use that Indian system of medicine to really do Tantra, because it's all about harmonizing the body and the mind with the elements. Ayurveda, as its most primordial level, is a system of harmonizing your body with the elements, with the earth, and with every element around it. So your body and your mind start to become harmonized with the seasons, with the planets, with the taste. And so when you do that, then you start to reconnect to that level. You're literally an embodied being. And then you can keep that body in balance, and then you can have a system so when you do practices, if something goes out of balance, you can rebalance it. It's there. So it literally is a type of alchemy.
Yeah, I see it like very much as like strengthening
absolutely
the physical form in order to be able to, bear more bliss or joy.
Yeah, it is.
Or whatever.
No,
because
it is.
If you're weak, you just can't,
do
endure
it.
That.
Absolutely, you can't endure it. And so it strengthens the body, it strengthens the vitality of your consciousness on a mental level, physical level. And so that it creates more joy in life.
Yeah.
So it's very life affirming. And so that I think if you have that, and then you have a system like Tantra, it's very practical. You know, Tantra will typically be dangerous if you're not taking care of yourself.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, and that's why I'm sometimes outspoken about substance abuse. Mm-hmm. I mean, substances have an interesting ability to stimulate states of consciousness, but yeah. They're also quite damaging to the nervous system.
Yes.
And so then there's no way around that. I mean, it could be a plant, and it can still damage your nervous system.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So even in Ayurveda, new certain plants had to be processed a certain way, or before you took certain plants, you'd have to take other plants, or after you took certain plants, you'd have a post-ritual use of herbs. And so I think even within using, you know, entheogens or any kind of substance, whether they're mushrooms or hallucinogenics, that they can be very problematic because they're just damaging to the body. Mm. And then that's also coupled with your own susceptibility, your own vitality. So I think those are interesting ideas. And once again, that Ayurveda can provide some idea about strengthening the body.
Yeah.
Because I think that idea of having to have a drug or a substance to stimulate an altered state is another escapist fantasy.
Yeah.
Because that's like basically saying we can't do it with our own body. We have to have something outside of ourselves. I see that no different as we have to have an outside savior. We have to have an outside this.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's very similar.
In esoteric Vudan and in Tantra, left-hand Tantra, and even in EGA cosmic alchemical apostolic practices, literal physical changes will happen in the body and the blood of the initiate, and that happens without taking substance.
Right.
That happens just through certain kind of magical practices, esoteric things we do within our systems. And of course, there other things can be done within that, but the actual practice itself can create an altered state.
Yeah, and I completely agree. That exactly matches what I've been taught and experienced with, like, ritual magic and
absolutely
meditation and breathing techniques,
definitely,
things like that. And when you combine them all, it is like the alchemical laboratory.
Literally.
Yeah. And you're right, you start changing your physiology, your blood chemistry, and things start happening.
Yeah, and so I think that's really, really important to discuss. That's why I'm such a it's so important for me to discuss Ayurveda with yoga, or Ayurveda with Tantra, or even using Ayurveda with even Vudan practices, harmonizing with the body and the seasons. It's really powerful.
Now, were your teachers, did they stress this, like, interconnection between these systems, or is this something you kind of came to?
Both. I mean, they definitely stressed it, and then through my deeper or different studies with different occult systems, I started to see connections. Mm-hmm. But I also thought that, I mean, that was why I always have a passion for Chinese medicine and Ayurveda and Western medicine, but all because all those systems of medicine really tie into the body as this magical system, magical machine, or maybe not even a machine. The body's mechanistic, but it's not a machine.
Yeah.
A magical apparatus, an instrumentum magicum. The body really is, and the body houses this consciousness, and so if we can, it's very important for us to learn various ways to keep that in balance.
Now, there's probably a few people who are listening to this who are, you know, they may have some sort of disability or have suffered some kind of disease or chronic health condition, and for people in that situation, I think they very much feel like their body is their enemy.
Yes.
A lot of the time, and they feel trapped in it.
Absolutely.
How does someone in that situation deal with that? How would you recommend that they kind of approach that?
Yeah, it's a really important question, because if oftentimes people hear things like, and they'll say when we say something like the body is a reflection of the soul, or the soul's a reflection of the body, I think many people see this modern commodification of the body, that means, oh, that you're going to be what society thinks is beautiful or fit. And that's not that at all. I mean, there might be a radiation from the body where that can happen, but you can also be someone who is disabled that has way more power in them to transmit and has a certain type of power around them than someone who is very completely abled. So I think that's number one. There's going to be something that's non-palpable that will cross that idea or cross the boundaries of what we think is normal. However, you're right. If someone has a physical disability, they feel like they're in a prison.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's another reason why I think Ayurveda is so important, because it can teach that person how to harmonize their body within their certain limitations, yeah. and then to help transmit that.
Yeah.
And so I think that true, any good integrative medical system should, mm-hmm. But I think that Ayurveda particularly has an ability, because it's so dealing with a physical, but also a psychological, but also a spiritual. And so if you combine those three together, then you can really, it's almost like getting a key to get out of that prison.
Yeah, yeah, interesting.
You know, and so that's what I think, but it's a, you ask a really good question, because that's a very serious thing for a lot of people.
Oh, right? Yeah.
If they're very sick and they're very, and so that's even why Ayurveda would say, okay, sometimes there's like physical medicine, other times there's psychological medicine, or they would have what they would call, you know, Divya Chikitsa, which meant divine therapies. Mm-hmm. And that's when they had more esoteric practices to heal, to balance. And so I think all those things need to be taken into account for all those things to happen. And our body, like I said before, is still limited. It's finite.
Yeah.
No matter how much we take Ayurveda into account, we're all going to age. and eventually our body's going to give out. But if we keep a certain kind of elan vital alive within us, then that we're not worried about that.
Mm-hmm.
We age, we know it's going to happen. We don't start to, you know, become depressed because we're older.
Mm-hmm.
We see that as our society now, this obsession with youth.
Yeah.
You know, they're just obsessed with being young or
and
looking.
Anybody who's old, or especially if you're dying, you're going to get put away, shut off in some closet somewhere.
We don't want to see that.
Right.
And so I think that is a kind of indicative of that big disconnection from...
That even like extends to the idea of like the whole factory farming thing.
Absolutely.
You know, which you've brought to my attention.
It's a big thing, yeah. It just shows the whole just like... commodification, turning everything into just a product,
mm-hmm.
and then we don't want to see it.
Right.
We don't necessarily even want to see how that happens. We just want something else. And so I think that's why I'm so, to me, even factory farming is such a dangerous thing. At least for the environment, obviously, but also spiritually,
yeah,
ethically.
Yeah,
it's a mirror of a lot of things that are going on. So, but I think these ideas of physical health and learning about mortality,
mm-hmm.
and looking at the body and aging and not being afraid of that.
Yeah, that's
those are tantric ideas.
Yeah, exactly.
Those are definitely tantric ideas. Because you want to get to the point where you're embodied, but also at the moment when you leave it, we want to have this state of consciousness which is not afraid to leave. Because it's just another transformation.
Yeah, you don't want to get trapped.
You don't want to get trapped into that.
Yeah.
And so that's also, too, why Tantra can be dangerous. Someone could be using practices and they might not be in a balanced way. And through their body, they just become addicted to body pleasures.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point you bring up. We're talking about using ritual or yoga, breathing techniques or other things maybe to kind of change your blood chemistry,
right,
produce these blissful states.
Sure.
I don't want to commodify that because it
yeah.
is a sacred thing.
Definitely, yeah.
But when it is so pleasurable, it is dangerous.
It's very dangerous.
Because you can get really attached to it.
You get completely attached to it, and then that's why you see this modern obsession with physical fitness. Which can be, many people are obsessed with physical fitness, but in actuality, they're completely disconnected from their body. It's a very ironic, it's just the same with this hypersexuality we have.
Yeah.
We use sex to sell things, people are obsessed with sex, but yet they're not healthy, they're not happy with their sexuality.
No.
They're very rarely sexually satisfied, they think it's dirty, mm-hmm. it's dangerous, and so it's all this disconnect that's going on with that.
Is.
And so I think that's also indicative of that, too. And that's why left-hand tantra can be so dangerous, because it really does immerse one into that viscerality of the body.
Mm-hmm.
But in the same sense that while that's going on, there has to be a type of transformation on all levels, psychological, emotional, mental, and physical, that while that's happening, it's literally creating a type of alembic, where a new state of consciousness is being incubated. And when that new state of consciousness starts to come out, which we would typically in our practice call that Kaivalya, it's a type of isolated consciousness which will exist once the physical body passes on. It's independent. of any kind of fears, and that's tough. That's hard. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Craig.
Yeah, it's been
always a pleasure to talk with
you. Yeah, it's been a pleasure, and thank you so much for having such interesting questions about my book, and we were able to really dive in, so I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, and you know, thank you again for doing the panel.
Absolutely, it was such a pleasure.
Coming to town, it was really a thrill.
Oh, it's awesome. It's an honor. It's just the beginnings.
In the Occult of Personality membership section, Craig Williams and I continue the conversation about his excellent book, Cave of the Numinous, including such wonderful subjects as the nature of the soul, cosmic gnosis, and the mysteries of Saturn. Don't miss that fascinating conversation. Just go to occultofpersonality.net/membership and sign up if you haven't already. It's the best way to support the podcast while receiving access to a tremendous amount of additional exclusive content. Thanks for listening, and until next time.
Thank you.